$10 billion is being cut from Medicaid annually, amounting to 10% of its annual budget being depleted. This will lead to 10 million Medicaid beneficiaries facing uninsurance. These figures are evidently alarming and are the potential reality, as they're the estimated effects the enactment of the One Big Beautiful Bill, or OBA, will have on both health insurance agencies and beneficiaries alike. While 10 million people only accounts for a small percentage of Americans in the U.S., less than 3%, the effects on Medicaid beneficiaries may have a ripple effect, impacting political, social, and economic outcomes across demographics.
OBA was signed into law by the Trump administration in July 2025, with many of its policy changes set to be officially implemented between 2027 and 2028. While it isn't going into practice for another year, its effects are already represented in everyday life. In this episode of State of the Pod, we will address the impact of OBA on Medicaid beneficiaries, impacts spanning across various sectors, such as politics, society, and economics. But the advantages and disadvantages are compared with real-world scenarios.
However, before we analyze the real-world examples of these effects, it's important to get a general overview of OBA. What are the changes exacerbating uninsurance rates, and how do these changes impact a wide range of people?
So what exactly is Medicaid? What are the changes OBA made that are affecting Medicaid beneficiaries, and why do these changes actually matter?
So Medicaid is a jointly funded health insurance in which both the federal government and the states pay a part in providing health insurance coverage for care, including both inpatient and outpatient care, physician services, nursing home care, and other mandatory benefits. While Medicare is more solely focused on providing health insurance coverage for the elderly, Medicaid is more far-reaching. The floor, or minimum requirements for coverage, across all 51 states include low-income children, pregnant women, and blind and disabled individuals.
As aforementioned, those receiving Medicaid coverage constitute only 3% of the total U.S. population. However, the enacted changes may impact people on a much larger scale.
The National Association of Medicaid Directors summarizes some of these Medicaid policy changes. Several of these changes being, first, funding restrictions for providers providing reproductive services. Second, increasing the Rural Health Fund. Third, narrowing eligibility for immigrants. Fourth, federal work requirements being implemented. Fifth, cost-sharing requirements. So now let's transition to how these changes actually impact the healthcare system. Specifically, I want to talk about Medicaid beneficiaries that so heavily rely on the funds from federal and state levels.
Provider funding restrictions constitute a temporary, one-year restriction of federal funding to providers that offer reproductive health services, such as abortions. These providers must meet specific criteria to be qualified for this restriction, including having been paid at least $800,000 for Medicaid beneficiaries in 2023.
It begs the question whether this may reduce accessibility to reproductive care. If physicians must take a pay cut for providing extensive reproductive services, they may prioritize private insurance beneficiaries over public insurance beneficiaries, such as those on Medicaid. Physicians already get paid much more by private insurance companies compared to their public insurance counterparts. In fact, the National Bureau of Economic Research emphasizes that when private insurance pays for the five most common patient diagnosis groups, it pays hospitals 37% more than Medicare does. Also, Medicaid pays 21% less than Medicare.
Physicians are already financially incentivized by these pre-existing pay differentials to widen the gap in accessibility to physician services between public and private health insurance beneficiaries. OBA's proposed funding cut may exacerbate this difference.
A potential positive value, on the other hand, though, is that OBA is providing a large rural health fund, a $50 billion grant awarded to states meeting specific rural health care spending criteria, according to the National Association of Medicaid Directors. The CDC notes rural areas tend to have higher rates of mortality associated with chronic disease compared to their urban counterparts. This grant may provide rural hospitals with more resources to address this health disparity, diminishing this access gap between rural and urban areas.
OBA benefiting rural areas is not a belief upheld by everyone. Chris Rucker, Value Health Chief Administrative Officer, in an interview on Fox 5, pointed out that there are more Medicaid beneficiaries in rural areas than urban areas. coupled with higher rates of chronic disease. This being said, cutting Medicaid funding may disproportionately affect these rural areas more than urban areas. It remains debated what the long implications to rural areas may be, whether they will be disadvantaged, widening the disparity gap, or it may narrow when grants are awarded to their hospital facilities.
Another contentious change is the narrowing of eligibility for immigrants. The National Association of Medicaid Directors specifically notes that refugees, asylees, and other humanitarian groups are barred from eligibility. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office projects that about 1.4 million lawfully present immigrants may face uninsurance. While 1.4 million people lose access to federally and state-funded health care, the Congressional Budget Office notes that the government saves around $131 billion.
This poses the question of whether the government should prioritize health for everyone within its borders, or should it restrict it to save money? As arguably the richest nation on earth, but a nation that is also in debt, what should be prioritized? Should it use its power to help the greatest number of people, or save money, enabling it to spend more on the select amount of people?
Federal work requirements are another change Medicaid beneficiaries are facing. The National Association of Medicaid Directors explains these requirements in detail. Prospective beneficiaries aged 19 to 64 must commit to at least 80 hours a week of either work, education, or community service if they are to be eligible for Medicaid.
While this policy aims to increase employment rates by incentivizing work in exchange for Medicaid eligibility, some experts believe it would not affect employment rates and will instead have an adverse effect on the number of insured. Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy explains around 5.5 to 6.3 million adults aged 19 to 64 will lose coverage from these work requirements.
What's interesting is that the source notes that 9 out of 10 of these enrollees would otherwise meet this work requirement. What is instead leading to uninsurance rates is confusion on how to meet the eligibility requirements and demonstrate proof through proper documentation.
Patient cost sharing has also had a mandated increase for Medicaid beneficiaries. Health policy nonprofit, the Kaiser Family Foundation, or KFF, explains this policy change in detail. Adults in expansive states that are within an income range of 100% to 138% of the federal poverty level are required to pay up to $35 out of pocket per service. There are some exceptions, as services within several categories, including but not limited to emergency care and mental care, they don't count for needing to abide by this policy.
Rising cost-sharing expenditures may make receiving necessary medical care less accessible for individuals, especially for traditionally low-income Medicaid beneficiaries that rely on state and governmental financial assistance for health insurance.
I think what's important to mention here is the way Congress responds over the next few years will determine what actually happens to Medicaid and Medicare beneficiaries. Right now, Congress is deeply polarized, and that polarization has stalled any meaningful progress on addressing the Medicare Part A insolvency timeline, or, more generally, when the pot of federal funds for Medicare is expected to run dry, which, before OBA, was projected for 2033. Democrats and Republicans have fundamentally different approaches to fixing this, and those differences shape how OBA is interpreted and whether its cuts will face resistance or reinforcement.
Democratic proposals generally focus on increasing federal revenue and reducing waste. This includes raising taxes on high-income earners and implementing stronger cost controls than private insurance plans. Their broader stance frames Medicare as a guaranteed insurance plan that must be preserved. They argue that shifting Medicare toward a premium support model would weaken that guarantee and increase out-of-pocket costs for older adults over time, especially as private plans cherry-pick healthier people.
Republican proposals tend to emphasize reducing federal spending through program cuts and increased costs for beneficiaries. Many GOP platforms support raising the Medicare eligibility age, transitioning Medicare into premium support, and shrinking federal obligations in exchange for more consumer choice. Whether or not these proposals would actually stabilize the trust fund is debated. But the core disagreement shows why Congress has been unable to pass long-term reforms.
Public opinion adds another layer. Research from Northeastern University shows that the majority of Americans across political parties oppose cutting Medicare and Medicaid, with 76% opposing Medicare cuts and 68% opposing cuts to Medicaid. Even among Republicans, more than half oppose reducing funding to either program. So while Congress is split, the public sentiment is overwhelmingly against the types of cuts OPA enacts.
Another major factor shaping this moment is that the expected Affordable Care Act premium tax credits are scheduled to expire at the end of 2025. These enhanced subsidies significantly lowered marketplace premiums during the past few years, and if they're allowed to lapse, premiums could rise sharply.
For example, a six-year-old couple at just over 400% of the federal poverty level could end up paying over $22,000 per year in premiums compared to the capped percentage they pay now. Insurers have already filed proposed rate increases for 2026, anticipating the possibility that subsidies won't be renewed. Congress has several options, ranging from short-term extensions to permanent renewal, but each comes with a large budget impact. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that permanently extending the enhanced subsidies would cost around $350 billion over 10 years, while keeping about 3.8 million more people insured.
OBA itself also has drawn criticism from advocacy groups. According to the Medicare Rights Center, the law restricts ACA tax credits, limits Medicare eligibility for certain lawful residents, and ends some streamlined enrollment rules that helped low-income beneficiaries sign up for assistance. They estimate that roughly 1.4 million lawful residents may lose help with their Medicare Part B premiums as a result. The same analysis warns that if OBA contributes to higher deficits, automatic federal budget rules like PAYGO could trigger up to $45 billion in Medicare cuts as early as 2026.
The direction of health policy in the U.S. has always depended heavily on who controls Congress and the presidency. Divided government typically leads to patchwork reforms and administrative actions rather than sweeping legislative changes, which means the effects of OBA could worsen or soften depending on the outcome of the next election cycle.
Ultimately, these political dynamics, partisan gridlock, public opposition to cuts, the expiration of ACA subsidies, and the risks posed by automatic budget rules, create a highly uncertain environment for Medicaid and Medicare beneficiaries. OPA doesn't operate in isolation. It's interacting with a broader system already under strain. And the decisions Congress makes over the next few years will determine whether access to care narrows, stabilizes, or improves.
Also, OBA is expected to impact the social benefits of Medicaid.
In 2018, researchers conducted a study that compared low-income children in states that chose to expand Medicaid eligibility with children in states that did not. This study found that children with access to health care, on average, experienced more success as adults. They were more likely to graduate high school than attend college, had higher-paying jobs, and were less reliant on welfare. In essence, steady access to health care allowed low-income children to build a better life for themselves.
They even found that the increase in taxes and production from stable, healthy adults essentially paid for the cost of Medicaid in the long run. Steady healthcare coverage has also been linked to improved long-term mental and physical health. These benefits are expected to be reproduced by the impending increase rate in uninsurance.
For those that are still able to get Medicaid, it is predicted that the quality of healthcare available will be worse. There are currently, before OBA has taken effect, many doctors and hospitals that do not accept new Medicaid patients because Medicaid pays less compared to Medicare or private insurance. I'm sure many of you are familiar with long wait times and scheduling appointments months in advance. This is more dire for people with Medicaid, as many doctors do not participate in Medicaid. This leaves thousands struggling to access life-saving care.
Beyond the conversation of budget cuts, it might be striking to hear that last year the United States spent over $4.5 trillion on healthcare. That's nearly 18% of the entire U.S. economy, more than any other high-income nation. And yet, despite this enormous investment, healthcare consumers still struggle to understand prices, compare quality, or predict what they'll owe when they walk into a doctor's office. It raises a deceptively simple question. Why doesn't healthcare behave like a normal market? Why don't typical rules of supply and demand create transparent pricing, efficiency, and competition the way they do in most sectors of the economy?
I think we should first think about what makes a normal market work. Consumers compare prices, decide whether a product is worth buying, and adjust their behavior based on cost. Producers respond to demand by changing prices or improving the product. In healthcare, almost none of that logic holds true. People don't shop for emergency surgery. They can't predict the timing of illness. And unlike buying a new laptop, choosing a hospital or specialist often happens under fear, uncertainty, or time pressure.
A major reason for this is information asymmetry, the idea that one side of a market knows far more than the other. In this case, physicians and insurers typically understand the medical and financial landscape far better than patients do. According to the Healthcare Cost Institute, prices for the same procedure can vary by thousands of dollars within the same city, yet patients rarely have the information or the medical expertise to compare options.
When one side has all the knowledge, the typical consumer choice model breaks down. But even if patients did have perfect information, insurance dramatically alters incentives. Economists call this the moral hazard. When people are insulated from the full cost of care, they tend to use it more. It's not about intentional overuse. It's simply human nature. If the out-of-pocket price is low, the financial trade-off change. On the other hand, when deductibles are too high, patients may avoid necessary care altogether. The RAND Corporation has documented this for decades. Higher cost sharing reduces both low-value and high-value care, meaning even needed treatments drop when prices rise for the patient.
The flip side is adverse selection, a problem insurers face when sick individuals are more likely to buy comprehensive coverage than healthy ones. Without mechanisms to balance the risk pool, premiums spiral upward. The result is a tug of war between insurers trying to keep premiums affordable and patients trying to find coverage that meets their needs. This delicate balance defines the insurance landscape and shapes the pricing strategies we see in the market today.
Let's turn now to the supply side, the structure of healthcare provider markets. Over the last two decades, hospitals have rapidly consolidated. The American Hospital Association reports that more than half of hospital markets in the U.S. are now considered highly concentrated. With fewer competitors, the bargaining power of large hospital systems increases dramatically. When these systems negotiate with private insurers, they can command higher prices for services, often without major improvements in quality. This is one reason why privately insured patients frequently face much higher costs than those covered by Medicare.
The physician labor market also adds complexity, since medical training takes years and is tightly regulated, meaning supply can't adjust quickly to demand. Shortages in primary care and certain specialties create bottlenecks that further elevate prices and reduce access, especially in rural areas. Pharmaceuticals and medical technology introduce yet another layer of economic uniqueness. Drug prices in the U.S. are notoriously high, partly because of patent protections designed to reward innovation.
These patents allow companies to temporarily act as monopolies, setting prices well above production costs. While the system encourages groundbreaking research, think mRNA vaccines or gene therapies, it also leads to steep prices that strain patients, insurers, and public programs alike. When patents expire, generic competition usually drives prices down, but only if competitors can navigate the complex regulatory and manufacturing hurdles required to enter the market. Beyond patent protections, market concentration further amplifies pricing power in the pharmaceutical sector.
In many drug categories, only a few firms dominate production, meaning even medications that should be inexpensive because they're old or off-patent can experience sudden price hikes if one manufacturer leaves the market or encounters production issues. The FDA has documented that these supply disruptions often lead to shortages, and shortages can push prices higher, not because of innovation, but because patients and providers lack viable alternatives. This combination of limited competition, high regulatory barriers, and fragile supply chains reveals how vulnerable the system is when just a few firms control essential products.
I also want to add on that healthcare economics wouldn't be complete without the Grossman model, which reframes health not just as something we consume, but as something we invest in. According to this theory, people produce health capital through exercise, preventative care, nutrition, and lifestyle choices. But health declines over time, meaning individuals must continually reinvest to maintain their well-being. This helps explain why preventative care can be more economically efficient than treating advanced and complex disease cases. It also sheds light on the socioeconomic disparities embedded in the system. people with fewer resources face higher costs of investing in their health, contributing to long-term inequity.
The government also plays an enormous role in stabilizing and, unfortunately, complicating these markets. Programs like Medicare and Medicaid insure millions, while regulations shape everything from physician licensing to insurance benefit requirements to hospital safety standards. These interventions exist because the typical market mechanisms would otherwise leave many people without care, create extreme price variation, or allow monopolistic behaviors to flourish. But government involvement also introduces trade-offs. More regulation could mean higher compliance costs, while less regulation could increase risk for consumers.
Understanding these economic forces doesn't solve the challenges, but it does explain why reform is so difficult and why simple solutions rarely work. Improving efficiency in healthcare means grappling with the unique ways this market operates, the incentives at play, and the real human consequences embedded in every financial decision.
So where does this all leave us? Healthcare markets sit at the intersection of uncertainty, biology, economics, and policy. They don't behave like the markets we learn about in an introductory economic class, and they likely never will. The combination of information imbalances, insurance distortions, market power, and technological complexity creates a system that is both essential and incredibly difficult to manage. Some aspects encourage innovation and progress. Others generate waste, inequity, and further frustration.
Before discussing the current state of Medicaid, both the advantages and disadvantages linked with OBA policy changes, it's important to get a general overview on the history of U.S. health insurance, its change over time, and how it got to where it is today. Chapter 1 of the textbook, Health Insurance, by Dr. Michael A. Morrissey, outlines the history of health insurance in the U.S.
While not officially enacted by the 16 states considering it, the first proposed health insurance came around the time of World War I, in which a compulsory or mandatory health insurance was proposed. This plan shows parallels to the Affordable Care Act enacted during the Obama administration, in which similarly, a compulsory health insurance was issued, requiring people get health insurance or facing a punishment, a monetary fee, as a consequence of failing to secure health insurance.
Following World War I, a Baylor plan was announced, in which patients paid a standard 50 cents for 21 days of service. Followed was a modified but more widespread implementation of this plan in California. This widespread implementation led to market competitiveness between hospitals, in which they valued lower prices to persuade patients rather than differentiating, creating unique products. This market competitiveness has stood the test of time, still being utilized in a consumer-direct healthcare system that the U.S. upholds today.
In 1929, there was a huge shift away from traditional fee-for-service systems. Prepaid group practices were the beginning of managed care, in which a group of providers work together rather than independently, and patients pay a set fee each month for medical services, rather than an individual fee for each service. Shifting to the 1940s, there came the development of employer-sponsored health insurance during World War II. While there were wage restrictions in place, disincentivizing employment in the factories to help supply the war effort, employers instead offered health insurance as a form of compensation to drive up employment and interest.
Following World War II, the insurance rates doubled. Moving forward in time to the 1960s and 70s, these eras saw a movement away from community-rated premiums and an implementation of experience rating. This meant that healthy insurance beneficiaries that did not require many services were rewarded with lower premiums, while those requiring more services had higher premiums.
Shifting to the 1980s to the present, managed care was fully developed in the 1980s, having been modeled off of the prepared group practices from the late 1920s. Three main versions were established: HMOs, PPOs, and POSs. HMOs tended to have the lowest premiums, but most utilization management, or restrictions in place to limit medical costs, while PPOs have the highest premiums, but have less restrictions in patients choosing physicians and medical services. POSs acted as a sort of intermediate. The 1980s also saw the expansion of Medicare with the adoption of Part D, expanding the The 1980s also saw the expansion of Part The 1980s also saw the adoption of Medicare Part D, expanding from the Part A and Part B established in the 1960s. Part D granted access to prescription drugs, expanding from the drug coverage under Part B.
Finally, fast-forwarding to the present, consumer-directed health plans are on the rise. These offer high deductibles but low premiums, optimal for healthy people, healthy patients that do not plan on needing medical services but want health insurance just in case.
So why does learning about the history of health insurance actually matter? How is it relevant to OBA?
It becomes clear that a century of health insurance development is at risk of being completely undone from the policy effects of OBA, while others may argue that this history represents a growing need to upheave the healthcare system, which OBA may or may not be doing effectively, depending on one's viewpoints.
Irrespective of our viewpoints or personal opinions, past studies have shown that many of OBA's measurements may not have been effective. A work requirement, or one of the most prominent aspects of OBA, was implemented in Arkansas in 2018. To stay eligible, Medicaid beneficiaries between the ages of 30 to 50 were required to prove that they were working 80 hours per week, like we mentioned before, or that they were in job training or community service, or further had an exemption from pregnancy or other disabilities. Notably, 95% of current Medicaid beneficiaries would have qualified. However, like we mentioned, after this law was implemented, there was a significant drop in insurance with no change in employment. Instead, these complex additions and bureaucracy confused people, highlighting how the process of OBA and its implementation to the consumer market really can have direct effects on uninsurance despite eligibility requirements.
Transitioning over to potential advantages that OBA has on the U.S. healthcare system, there are two primary advantages that, although still highly contentious, some people believe will benefit the U.S. healthcare system. The accounting firm Baldwin CPAs explains the basis of both of these potential advantages.
The first advantage is that, one, rural hospital funding has doubled. The second advantage, companies can deduct entire research and development costs immediately. As mentioned previously, rural hospitals tend to have higher frequency of chronic disease-related deaths compared to urban hospitals. Increasing funding from $25 billion to $50 billion may help to narrow that disparity.
In practice, the implementation of Point 2 might look like, for example, if Hospital A spent $1 million on research and development in a given year, it historically would only be able to deduct a portion of this price annually, say $200,000. It can now deduct all of it, all $1 million, for example, meaning it does not have to pay taxes on all $1 million of the price for research and development. With this immediate deduction policy now in place, pharmaceutical companies may have more revenue up front to invest back into the company and projects, whether that be investing in marketing, equipment, more research and development, or beyond.
If there is no policy enacted immediately to address these disadvantages of OBA, the negative effects of OBA may become compounded as time goes on. This will make it even more difficult to address these negative effects, more difficult to climb out of this ditch the U.S. is digging itself into.
One of the main problems with OBA is that it may indirectly be accelerating the depletion of Medicare Part A. This traditionally grants essential medical coverage, such as inpatient care, to all Medicare beneficiaries. Before the passing of OBA, the 2025 Medicare Trustees Report projected that the Medicare Part A Trust Fund would be fully depleted by 2033. However, this date is likely to be impacted after the passing of OBA.
The Committee for Responsible Federal Budget explains that OBA policies reduce revenue from income taxation on Social Security benefits, in which these taxes traditionally are used partly for the Medicare Part A Trust Fund. If there are no immediate reforms, the Medicare Part A Trust Fund may be depleted at an accelerated rate in correlation with OBA policy changes. This may put the elderly and disabled, current and future beneficiaries, at risk of lacking coverage due to a depleted federal health insurance budget. Realistically, however, the government is not likely to let Medicare Part A run out fully.
The problem? A potential alternative is to reduce physician payments from Medicare and Medicaid to partially make up for the depleted funds. A further reduced accessibility to medical care. Physicians may be even less willing to take them on as patients because they pay with health insurances that are paying far less than they have previously, which is already below private insurance reimbursement rates. As already mentioned, Medicare and Medicaid pay significantly less than private health insurances, so there's already an accessibility gap, which may be further exacerbated by OBA.
The reduction of Part A trust fund at the partial fall of OBA policy may widen this inaccessibility gap between the advantaged, those with enough money for private health insurance, and the generally disadvantaged, those requiring federal and or state assistance through either Medicare and or Medicaid.
So while the outlook of OBA might vary a lot with policy changes and, like we mentioned, Congress in the future, I want to say throughout this episode we've discussed a lot about healthcare markets and necessary reforms we see. But if we could all maybe pick one thing that we want people to remember, what would it be?
I'd just like to highlight the urgency of the problem of the Medicare Part A trust fund running out. It can lead to this perpetual cycle of disadvantaging those qualifying for Medicare and Medicaid. This is because a primary means to counteract this trust fund running out may mean to pay these physicians through these government-sponsored health insurance, such as Medicare. Medicare would be paying the physicians less money, right? And so these physicians may be less willing to take on these patients. This may widen this inaccessibility gap between those that have this private insurance and those that have these federally and state-sponsored insurance like Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah, and I think adding on to that point, something I want people to take away is specifically the economics aspect of this. Not only do we see already with the bureaucracies and different steps in place to actually getting coverage that there's such an inequity in access to care, we see the fact that the healthcare market is so unique in nature. It's not like any other market in the world, even in the United States, the U.S. healthcare market, that understanding it is another barrier to care. A lot of people don't understand how to shop around for care. They don't know tools like the Open Payments Database, where you can actually look at your physician's history of what they've been paid, who they've been endorsed by. All of these tools that policymakers and people in the field who are professionals might know, they're not generally very accessible to everyday people, which is why I believe it's really important to take away how unique this market is and how different it is on the insurer side, the policymaking side, the physician side, the patient side, and even family members, caregivers, or anybody else involved in this equation.
I think something I want people to take away is that even if the policies on paper seem to be beneficial. For example, with the work requirement, it seems very easy to pass for people to get eligible. Just submit your papers on time and you'll get it. But as seen in the Arkansas case, these work requirements, eligibility requirements are very confusing and are very difficult for people to get information on. One of the things that the paper highlighted was how this was especially bad for people who did not have access to the internet, because the telephone system that was set up was incredibly inefficient and at times non-functional. One of the main things that OBA also did was it cut funding for Medicare navigators, whose whole job was to help people find health insurance. So I think one thing to gather is that this whole system is going to be much more confusing.
Yeah. I think also what you're saying really highlights the disconnect between people and policies. Mm-hmm. We see policymakers might not be as accustomed to the difficulties the everyday person, especially people like the elderly who are looking for Medicare, might face when trying to find this care. So I just think that's an important note to take away too, how people in the policy room and people in practice and people in all different parts of the system, insurer side, physician side, office side, don't always understand what the other group is going through.
An open-ended question I want people to take away is, how would these affect me? You know, some of people might be thinking, you know, I'm not on Medicare, I'm not on Medicaid, I have private health insurance. If Medicaid is cut, how will that affect me?
Yeah, I want you, as we're kind of closing up this episode, I want you to think about this far-reaching effects that, you know, the policies that OBA has enacted, how it doesn't just affect these Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries, but it essentially changes our entire healthcare ecosystem. It's going to change how you receive your care. So I want you to think about, as we close up, how do you think you're going to be affected? You might not think about it on a surface level, but the next time you have an extended wait time in a hospital or at your doctor's office, I want you to think about that implication of that, right? How that stems from this interconnectedness of the healthcare system, right? And how these policy effects from OBA kind of had this wide-ranging effects on the entire healthcare ecosystem, both those on these federally and state-funded health insurances and also people on private insurance.
As you reflect, these have been your hosts, Rama,
Shane,
and Irina.
And this has been State of the Pod. Thank you for listening.